What a great morning. You're very welcome, friends. I'm Adrian Flannelly, and I will be with you for the next 3 hours. Now, you don't have to be with us for the entire 3 hours. It's just that if you are, you get a prize. That means you've killed your morning, because we're on here until 12 o'clock. It is, I think, hold on a second now, here, this is live programming, you have to see. It's 74 degrees in New York, and it's clear, it's lovely, and we are going to have a fabulous day, a couple of days, actually, with the temperatures, say, in the mid-80s, when all is said and done. So it's good. Everything is good. The program, friends, is being broadcast worldwide on irishradio.com. And this first hour, for those in the New York area, the metropolitan New York area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, you will find us on WNYE 91.5 FM, Public Radio, HD1, and on irishradio.com. So wherever you are in the world, let me say hello to you and bid you a good morning from New York City, capital of the world. With that in mind, let me tell you who's on our program today. Sitting beside me, we'll be hearing from her in a few minutes, is Miriam Nyhan, who is from County Wicklow, an adjunct professor of Irish Studies at New York University, program coordinator and faculty fellow at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, and her special interest and area of expertise is in 20th century immigration. Dr. Nyhan has focused primarily on the 1950s Irish immigrants who settled in New York and London. Anyway, we'll be chatting with her in a few minutes. City Field, get to City Field for Irish Night, friends, when the Mets take on the San Francisco Giants on Friday, August 1st. The Mets are offering fans all kinds of deals and special discounted pricing, and you know, I think everybody gets an Irish T-shirt. If you ever wanted an Irish T-shirt with the Mets emblem, I think this is an opportunity. I think I have one somewhere. Yeah, it's a size small, so it's obviously been around for maybe a half century or so. You can get that information on, actually, if you log on to our website, irishradio.com, we can link you in fact, to any and all information pertaining to what we would like you to know. Then in the second hour of this program here, we will be linking up with Jimmy Kerr from Ballymena in Northern Ireland. He's based here in New York City. He's an award-winning playwright. He's a member of the Dramatist Guild of America, and his latest collaboration called In Shorts will be performed by the renowned actress Geraldine Hughes. You know Geraldine, Belfast, Northern Ireland, and himself at the Irish Repertory Theatre on Thursday, July 17th, for one night only. And indeed, it's told through a series of short stories. And anyway, it gives a glimpse of both artists who came from very different but parallel experiences growing up in Northern Ireland during the same period. Jimmy will fill us in on that. And, friends, the World Cup of which I am an expert. That's why I want to just give you a synopsis. I'll tell you all I know about it. Most of Ireland, according to Kevin O'Connor, would be rooting for Germany tonight. Ha ha. Not Oliver Murphy and the people of my neighbouring parish in County Mayo, the Admiral Brown Society of Foxborough. That's the town. The town of Foxford will invoke the spirit of their famous son, Admiral Brown, as Argentina meets Germany in the 2014 World Cup final tomorrow, Sunday. And why will they be on the Argentinian side? Well, that's obviously in recognition of the strong links that exist between Foxford and Argentina. Again, Admiral Brown, the founder of the Argentinian Navy. I took a risk there. I think that's what it is. But people in Mayo will be, if you're listening to us, hello, home county of Mayo, hello, Foxford. We'll have news and sports with Kevin O'Connor at 11 o'clock, and that will be sponsored by Tourism Ireland. All our programs are live streamed on irishradio.com, and then they're archived. So if there's anybody, if there is an interview that you might like to hear, whether it's today's or last week, last month, last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever it is, log on to irishradio.com. And if you can't find it, then you can complain to Áine Sheridan, who is the executive producer of all programmings on Irish Radio, and all programs, I should say, and Áine is also president of Flannelly Promotions and Irish Radio Network, USA. Friends, again, it's a lovely day in New York, and I suppose we could do worse than play a tune. By the way, we have a surprise guest in a half an hour. I'll tell you what about that. It has to do with Riverdale. It has to do with let me see, is it Ascension Parish? We'll find out from the lawyer, Tom Hughes, about big things happening in a big reunion and a hooli and a get-together and so forth. Miriam Nyhan is from Wicklow. And actually, there's a Wicklow song that's up here, which is extremely mournful and patriotic. And if you give me a minute, I'll see if I can get even a better one. Meanwhile, our address, easiest way to get in touch with us, is friends to drop us an email, info@irishradio.com. This program is generally very lopsided, because if you wanted to play, like if I wanted to play now a Wicklow song like Among the Wicklow Hills, there are really only two artists in the database here, which is highly suspicious, because both of them are from Longford. And as I was saying, you know, you're one actually has her own preferences. But anyway, let's try Larry Cunningham's version of Among the Wicklow Hills. Friends, the program, the Flannelly Show, live from New York City.
I just received a letter from my home in Ireland. The scribbled so familiar was my mother's feeble hand. a house that rang with music, and of laughter now is still. Dear Danny is so lonely now above the Wicklow Hill. As I gaze across the mountain, I relive a moment's joy. The same old Wicklow mountains where you rambled as a boy. Your photo as a child, that picture's by your bedside still. And each night I pray that you'll come back home among the Wicklow Hills. I have roamed this wide world over, I've sailed the seven seas. I got no chains around me, I just wander where I please. Now I met a girl I can't forget, she just won't leave my mind. And where she lives or where she's gone, I guess I'll never find. She wore a silver locket with a picture of her home. Just a lonely little cottage on a hillside all alone. Now I wonder where this cottage was, but all she let me know that it's somewhere on the borderline of Galway and Mayo. It's long and many a year ago since I left my native land. It's been no...
Oh, that's typical there of... the long 4 years, you know, they couldn't sing one song, and they'll go at that. He'll, Larry is going on now, and he's going to sing away for the next half an hour, but he'll be on his own. Anyway, the program's fans are live, and that is why, if I don't have notes, and even when I do, I don't read them anyway, I might say that the parish in the Bronx that Tom Hughes, our cousin Tom Hughes, will be telling us about, is not Ascension Parish at all. Miriam, what parish is it again?
I believe it's Visitation.
Visitation Parish. Oh, there you are. Okay, so anyway, in the meantime, friends, let me welcome Miriam Nyhan, who, again, is a coordinator and faculty fellow, Dr. Nyhan. I have this terrible pain in my neck. I don't know what the hell it is. But anyway, that's probably not, you can't help us with that one. How are you doing?
Good, very good. How would one do on a lovely morning like this?
Isn't it terrific?
Yeah.
All right, anyway, listen, just between ourselves now, because we're not really publicizing this at all, because we would need to get our act together a little bit more. But on this first hour of programming, we are going to, I was going to say turn over, which we will eventually, but... The first hour of this program is going to be taken over by Glucksman Ireland House at NYU. And that's for a very good reason, because you have loads and 21 years of archives and information in Glucksman Ireland House. A lot of it has not gotten out. And so, Miriam, tell us a bit about, if you will, Glucksman Ireland House.
Well, Glucksman Ireland House was the brainchild of Loretta and Lou Glucksman 21 years ago, as you said, Adrian. It opened April 26, 1993. And since then, since a rather small beginning in terms of what people envisioned. I just don't think people envisioned then that it would evolve into what it does today in terms of its reach. Our primary remit is in terms of offering undergraduate and now in more recent years graduate classes in Irish and Irish American Studies as the Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies at New York University. But there are so many, we wear so many different hats at Luxman Ireland House in terms of public outreach, our public event series, our oral history programme, our archives, the Archives of Irish America, which was established in the late 90s, 1997. So at this point in time, it really is a quite dynamic place that touches on the lives of a variety of people, be they freshmen, NYU students who come in and have an interest in taking an Irish language class, be they an empty nester who decides he or she would like to go back and pursue our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies because their kids have gone off to college and they've always had a passion for Irish history or Irish literature, or the people who come to our regular public events in the fall and spring semesters where there's a dynamic public event series offering lectures, performances, concerts, everything and everything like that.
Yeah. I want to ask you, though, about the interest in Irish studies. Across the United States, there are a number of universities, some of them indeed with relatively small classes interest in Irish studies. And they've been around for decades. What level of interest is there in Irish studies?
I think that there's an immense interest, especially, Adrian, in a city like New York, where the footprint of the Irish, so to speak, as an immigrant group has been so strong and so protracted over time. What's interesting about NYU is that historically it wasn't an institution that had a strong Irish studies or a link to, you know, some of the Catholic universities, some of the ones that have been around much longer. But I think generally what I notice when I talk to people who are interested in our graduate program in particular, there's a real thirst in the tri-state area and beyond for people who are really interested in academically pursuing and intellectually engaging with aspects of Irish history, literature, music, culture in a way that they didn't have possibly an opportunity before, or with the evolution of these courses more and more in these programs, that people can see a way to pursue their passion and also get accredited for a good a degree that stands.
Right.
Stands in multiple locations.
Okay. My job, and it will be your job, is when things are going very well once in a while, you have to put the cat amongst the pigeons. Let me ask you, as we go back to our own growing up in Ireland, Gaelic, the Gaelic language, I don't know if this applied to Wicklow, but I do know in the west of Ireland that there was great emphasis on the Gaelic language, and many of us who learned most of our subjects off Scaelge in Gaelic found out that that was kind of an exercise in futility because there was again Oscailge Drahakel, a kind of a pale an understanding that Gaelic, you were doing this for patriotic reasons, but that actually Gaelic was pretty much a dead language, and as such you weren't going anywhere with it anyway. I think we had to come to America to actually feel this tremendous interest in heritage and whatever. There are still some people, indeed, who do take up Irish language either as a subject or many people just to get kind of the feel of our ethnicity. Is there, and you have done your research now, not only you know, in the United States in particular, but you also in doing your doing your research, and then particularly in taping for the oral history at Glaxman Ireland House at NYU, you taped a great number of immigrants, particularly, who left Ireland, most of them because they had to. They came to New York, they came to America, they also went to London. Now, if you were to give us kind of, is there a common theme of immigrants from Ireland? Do they become, let's say, more Irish when they leave Ireland? Is there a kind of, is there a level of, and I know for some of us, we definitely became more aware of our Irishness and of our background when we came to New York and America.
I think, Adrian, to some extent it depends on where the people go. I think that the history of Irish immigration, for example, to the United States and particularly to New York, meant that Irish migrants did so. Kind, you could say they became more Irish than the Irish themselves. But I think generally, Adrian, and I always like to step out of the Irish case a little bit to see, you know, you can only really relate the Irish example by some kind of comparison with other groups as well. I think generally, especially people who come from a place where it has been rather homogenous, or there's a level of homogeneity. I mean, I'm a bit younger than you, Adrian, but I left the same type of Ireland.
Well, that's a great point.
I left the same profile of Ireland.
Everybody is an awful lot younger than me.
But I left an Ireland that was pretty homogenous in terms of religion, ethnicity, race, and general outlook. So, when you're in a place where everyone's kind of the same as you, you don't really think about difference. Or I think sometimes, you know, to go back to, you know, the old phrases and hackneyed terms in terms of, like, you know, reflecting on the homeland when you go away and stuff like that, and thinking about that more. I do think that there is truth in that, but I also do think it depends on where people are going in terms of how much they can embrace their sense, for example, of Irishness. Because when you compare, at least on the basis of my research, when you compared the group of immigrants who left, and again, I'd point out it was from a scholarly point of view, a great group to look at because they were pretty similar in terms of levels of education and the kind of Ireland they had left, many of them coming from rural locations, etc., etc. But their experiences of Irish New York and Irish London were not radically different, but significantly different in the time period that I looked at. Today, when you look at Irish immigrants, the profile of immigrants has changed in terms of levels of education and things like that.
Yeah.
And that's not to diminish. One of the things I noticed, Adrian, a lot in London and in New York and other places I've been where I've met the profile of people who left between 1946 and 1961. What I used to find kind of humbling when I'd meet these people is they'd say, "Oh, aren't you great getting the education?" And I'm the first generation of my family to go to college, not to mention go on and do a PhD. That was a big jump. You know, if you go back to the census records for my grandparents, it's farmers for generations. But what has impressed me so much about that group of immigrants, many of whom might be listening today, is how well they did on the basis of, you know, relatively low levels of education, but the quality of the education was pretty good. And one of my colleagues, Linda Dowling-Almeida, has done some interesting research in comparing, you know, people coming from Ireland with leaving school maybe at 14 years of age, but the what they had covered in terms of the education at that point was comparable to what American kids were graduating high school with, on balance. I had a fairly good experience of learning the Irish language. I had a very good experience, I should say. Wicklow isn't a place where one might think there was a strong influence of Irish language. I was very fortunate to have gone to a primary school, a national school, the local national school in Arklow.
Grammar school, yeah.
Yeah, that had Kerry, teachers from Kerry, and they were strict about the Irish, and they... It was, for some reason, for me and for my sisters, we actually enjoyed it and had a great experience of it. And I'm grateful that the longer I'm at Luxman Ireland House, when I have the opportunity to use it. I was up in Springfield, Massachusetts in April, Adrian, and I had the great honour of interviewing a man we're hoping to have at Luxman Ireland House in the fall. Michal O'Carna, Mike Carney, Dr. Mike Carney, he has been bestowed an honorary doctorate from NUI Maynooth in recent years. And he's one of the last surviving Blasket Islanders. He left the island in 1938 and has been in Springfield, Massachusetts since the mid-50s. Wow. And it was just such an honor and humbling experience to sit down and talk to that man and hear this beautiful Blasket Island Irish, uncorrupted, the phraseology, the dialect. I mean, that's touching.
The Blasket history. Islands, of course, off the most westerly part of Kerry.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's like a double immigration when you think of the Blasket Island going onto the mainland. Was a rare occasion. It's not like they were over and back on the ferry every day.
Absolutely, because when I spoke to him, Adrian, it was one thing I remarked about because, you know, my Irish is a bit rusty because I don't use it that often all the time, and especially I'd feel a little bit sometimes overwhelmed going to talk to a native speaker, and sometimes, you know, the dialect and the accent can be strong and the phrasing is so strong that if you're not a native speaker from that area, that it's kind of hard to keep up at times. And when I started talking to him, and I had noticed it on the phone when I spoke to him before I'd gone up to him, he was slow and clear speaking. And I asked him about it, because I've been in Kerry, down in the Gaeltacht areas. Yeah. I know how they can clip the language and talk really fast. And I remarked, I said, "My God, are you slowing down now to be clear for me, or is it because you've been 50 years in the United States and you've gotten used to speaking to people at a certain pace?" And he said, "Oh no, Miriam," he said, "we always on the island, we always spoke slower. We've more time. You weren't in a hurry on the Blasket, so there was a bit. They spoke slower than the people a couple of miles in on the land in Dunqueen." You know, it's remarkable. And going back to the language, Michal O'Carna has penned his memoir with his son-in-law, Jerry Hayes, a great guy. And the name of the memoir escapes me right now, but I can mention it again. And it's in the English language. Jerry is American born, and he wrote it with him in English. But you can actually see, Adrian, the phrasing of the Irish. You know, the patterns of the Irish language are just so strong in even the English text, and it's so poetic and beautiful.
It's poetic and it is colourful.
Yeah.
And for us, our experience, let me speak for myself here, we thought actually that there was much more emphasis in, again, in the equivalent of the grammar school, much more attention given to learning the Irish, learning the Irish language. And then I put myself at the top of the list here. When you learn history and geography, Star Agus Chirolis, Askelga, it's great. Except you don't know where anything is. You know, that's why you have to wait 50 years after that before the GPS comes around. Otherwise, you'd never find your way anywhere. But there was in Ireland, and I'm don't know whether I know, and you've interviewed me for the Oral History Project at Ireland House. I was one of a small group of 300 that you have interviewed. Is there, in terms of parochialism, we say now, you know, tongue-in-cheek and, you know, all things are parochial and all things are local or whatever. But other than the general, is there something in the Irish emigrant that at the end of the day, you know, come right back to your province, of which there are four in Ireland, and then to your county, and then down to your, you know, your town or your parish, your village. Is that something that's developed here, or do you feel somebody who came from any part of Ireland sometimes as a defense mechanism and other times great pride because of sports or something else? What was your own feeling in your own research in that?
I think that, Adrian, what I find ironic, and a lot of my research, as you know, has focused on the county identity and the county associations. I looked at them in New York and London, and how loyalty to a county played itself out in the mid-20th century. What is ironic to me on one level is that the counties were a system of organising Ireland imposed by the British that became, to use the Hackney term, more Irish than the Irish themselves in terms of how we identify. But I think the roots of what you're getting at, you know, go right back into early Irish history in terms of the division of Ireland into kingdoms, into Tuatha, and the evolution just of, you know, varying parcels under which people might self-identify a sense of loyalty under their local king or whatever. Right. And over time, the county took on one level. But as you say, the townland, the town, has been remarkably persistent as well. You see it in other parts of Europe. I don't think it's something that comes about in the United States. I spent some time living in Italy, for example, and that notion of campanilismo, the Italian loyalty to the local, the bell tower in the local village and town. I live in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and right now they're commemorating one of those. There's a big festival there every year where they're commemorating one of those local towers, basically, in Italy, and that was imported to the United States. But I think in some of the some parts of Europe, and in Ireland, because we were an island off the far west coast, perhaps some of these local identities were a little stronger and persisted when we went abroad. But I don't think it's totally unique to the Irish.
Yeah, okay. You know, we have a tendency, and maybe this is with many other ethnics as well, you know, when we're stereotyped, we have tendency to have a grievance. But we kind of stereotype ourselves when it comes to, again, say, various organizations, or particularly in sports. And since today is World Cup Day, and I leave that to those who know something about it to discuss. But is that kind of is it a kind of tongue in cheek aspect of the of Irish people to again to say to have that kind of rivalry that some people, for instance, you know, particularly in sports and in Gaelic sports in Ireland, the county tomorrow, for instance, is the Connacht Championship, and those who really into sports and all the rest of it, for them it's like they're almost the same level of disappointment, say, that Brazil had when they were beaten by Germany in the World Cup. Is that something that you find is peculiar to either sections of Ireland, or are there some areas where they could, you know, care less?
No, I think, I mean, if you notice, Adrian, even with young, and I find this fascinating with some of the really, say, some of the J1 kids who come over during the summer and stuff like that. I actually
met... These are temporary visas, legal visas issued by the US government to allow mostly students,
college students yeah,
to come over and work here for the summer.
And I met one on the train the other day, and the first thing she asked me was, where are you from? What county are you from? Mm-hmm. We do that. I do think that, and Jolie is kind of interesting to talk, or not, I shouldn't say kind of interesting.
Yeah.
He's very interesting to talk to about how these kind of methods of identification come out of a small, relatively static society, you know, because we, and the thing as well, Adrian, people always forget this, we've had very high levels of migration off the island, out of Ireland, but
right,
we had, until very recently, there was very little internal migration within, so local identities, the local kind of identity is very, very much something that was, you know, people didn't move necessarily from one county to another that often.
Yeah. You can say that, though, because you're from Wicklow, but when you look at, you know, at, I left in 1959 from Ireland, and most people, particularly those who went on to high school and who were not afforded... you know, an opportunity to say, go into farming or whatever. They had to go somewhere. I immigrated to the United States. I immigrated to New York. The rest of the family, which we can say tongue-in-cheek, they don't particularly like it, was the rest of them immigrated to Dublin, because that's where work was, that's where opportunity was, and as such... you know, it was the West of Ireland, again, has such identity in the East Coast of Ireland, you know, that even the generations that have Dublin, real Dublin accents, are very quick to point out, you know, that they're from Mayo, they're from Kerry, they're from Donegal, they're from somewhere, because they have that kind of identity. Well, you know they're Dubs, but they have this kind of pride in their own heritage.
Yeah, or in Dublin you can get the North Side, you know, Northsiders very proud of being Northsiders, or Southsiders, or vice versa. But you're talking to someone, Adrian, who's the daughter of two blow-ins, my mother's Laois and my father's West Cork. And they ended up in Wicklow. What I'm saying is, though, on balance, in terms of our levels of outward migration and in comparison with other groups historically, until quite recently, we'd very low levels of people moving around the country that much, which I think kind of encouraged the local identities to remain strong for probably longer periods of time. But they're still strong today. And, you know, the GAA, I mean, that's a whole... We could do hours on this, and I think at some point maybe we'll talk about the GAA is a remarkable organisation in terms of how it has evolved into something that's so embedded in society, not way beyond sport. I know very little about the intricacies of GAA locally or on the national level.
I'm delighted to hear that.
but I know how important it is in terms of how people identify.
I wanted to tell you now that this is known, well, for listeners through the years would know that I never pass up an opportunity to point out that actually I spent more time in Gaelic Park in the Bronx than most of Ireland's and Irish America's finest athletes. I don't get credit for that because actually I was playing an accordion on the stage, which is a very important position to have because fathers at the time would take their kids to Gaelic Park to the football games. Mm-hmm. And then they would kind of release them when the game started and they would come into the dance hall where we were playing. And the kids learned about Irish music while they were also playing frisbee. They would take the paper plates and fling them at us. And it was very cultural. It was there. But, I mean, many people, you know, would say, you should know something about sports. Weren't you in Gaelic Park for all those years and so forth? Yeah, but, you know, we were kind of afraid to open the window because you'd get a can or a bottle in the window. So, no, actually, I didn't. But I did. I spent a lot of time in Gaelic Park. And I want to trot out for the record. My co-host, my guest, friends, is Miriam Nyhan, and who runs pretty much everything down at Glucksman Ireland House, particularly when Joe Lee, who's the boss man, when he's in Ireland, he's got a good deal going, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. He does. Maybe one day, Adrian, we'll have jobs like that.
No, he does a good job, but he also, in the summertime, he returns to Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. He does. Yeah. He gets to Ireland a lot of the summer to do stuff to work on his books.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Listen, Marion is going to be sticking around for us for a while, but actually, I have I have two cousins, and they've been sleeping together for at least 50 years that we know of. And we've gotten over the embarrassment of that, and I just heard my cousin Eileen Hughes talking in the background. I think she was kind of complaining that we didn't put her husband Tom on the program, but we are. So we were in Riverdale, and we're talking to, linking up with Tom Hughes. Tom, a native of the Bronx, a lawyer, an attorney for again more than a half a century, with indeed his expertise is in wills and estates. You might find him indeed at the law firm of O'Dwyer and Bernstein, though in his own career he has indeed has had his and continues to have his own law firm. Tom Hughes, you're very welcome indeed.
Well, hello there, Adrian. It's good to talk to you.
How are things?
Everything is fine, thank you. Terrific. We're doing well. It's a beautiful day.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it terrific? Now, we were talking to yourself, and just to clear up the situation, technically, and for full disclosure, our cousin in your household there is actually your wife Eileen, who the former Eileen O'Dwyer, who is the daughter of Paul O'Dwyer, many of whom our listeners would know, was a tremendous influence, a great credit indeed to the Irish and in particular. But you see, for us, since you guys are stuck together like magnets since the day that I first met you, you know, you have kind of earned, whether you like it or not, you have earned the title cousin. So, you know, we get the double whammy there.
You can call me cousin anytime. I've been called a lot worse than that, Adrian. Cousin is very mild.
And me too. You know, we're talking here with Miriam Nyhan, who is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, who's at Luxman Ireland House at NYU, and who has made a great career in studying and Irish immigration in specifically and the mid 50s from 46 to what was it?
61.
From 46 to 61. Now, Tom, you just tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of your growing up. We just got through talking about Gaelic Park there. You were a stone's throw from Gaelic Park.
We lived on that street on Irwin Avenue, which is the one that runs north and south right into the park. And we were down on 234th Street, which is just a few blocks down from the park. That's in Cambridge. And,
was that considered Highbridge?
No, no, just Cambridge. Highbridge was over.
Oh, sorry. No, no, it was Kingsbridge. Kingsbridge. Yeah, I got that. Welcome to live radio. Kingsbridge, but that would have been the northern end of Kingsbridge then.
Yeah, that's right, because after the park, you go up half a mile or so and you're in Yonkers, so on Broadway, so.
Right.
That would be the northwestern part of the Bronx, right?
Now, your father and your family, your father, the judge, tell us a little bit about your father and mother.
Yeah, they were born and raised down in Hell's Kitchen in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they didn't know each other until, for one reason or another, my mother's father and mother moved them up to that same street in the 20s.
Wow.
And my father's parents went down the street to on the same block. And it was there that they met each other, and then they were married, and after, you know, a few years, they were living over on Bailey Avenue when they got married, and then 238th Street. And then they bought a house on Irwin Avenue, too.
On Irwin Avenue. Now, how many in the family?
Well, there were, I have six brothers and a sister.
How about that?
Yeah. She's okay. She thinks she's the lucky one, but I think I'm the lucky one.
Well,
she has
very
seven
big,
brothers.
Very,
I have one sister.
Yeah, very... well, of course, that would have been not considered a huge family in your area for that time, right?
No, it was a little bit more than normal, but there were plenty of people like that.
Where did your father work as a judge?
Well, he was in both the Manhattan and the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
They had what they called the First Department, which was those two counties. And he was elected in about 1969. And he served then until the retirement age was 70.
Mm.
So he was 70 in around 1986.
Right.
Well, I guess, I don't know what it was. He was 70, but they would extend you for three periods of 2 years.
Yeah.
So when he was 76, it was 1986. And then he had to retire.
Yeah. Growing up in that neighborhood, predominantly Irish, or was it a mix?
Well, it was slightly mixed, but it was predominantly Irish. There were plenty of kids around to play with and go to school with and all that.
Yeah.
It was a true neighborhood. In other words, all the people minded your own your business for you. If you were doing something wrong, well, your mother knew about it before you got home.
I know. That was before the cameras, the security cameras. Yeah. The Visitation Parish would have been, was that the parish, did that cover most of that area of Kingsbridge and...
Yeah, I guess so. It goes from about 236th Street up to the Van Cortlandt Park,
yeah,
and then west over to Riverdale.
Over into Riverdale.
But
What?
It was a parish that was funny. It was made up of, originally, they had a couple of stores on Bailey Avenue and south of 238th Street. I mean, stores that would now be a cobbler shop or a butcher or whatever. But they had this priest had two stores, I think it was, with the camp chairs in them, and he made a church out of it.
Hey.
And then in due course, they got a few bucks, I guess, and they had they bought the property on Bailey Avenue, which ran through.
Right.
To Putnam Avenue, and they built the rectory and another building which has both the church and the school.
You know, what got my attention, I could hardly believe that when you were mentioning that the Major Deegan, first of all, didn't exist. The main disaster route out of New York City would have been, say, the West Side Highway, if you were in a hurry to get out. And that was actually in the 50s, which I could have found very hard to believe, that area, maybe you can help describe it for us. That area was all streets. You can't imagine, you know, what that, you know, getting out of New York and getting onto the thruway, which indeed barely existed if it did at that point. But they literally came in and took out a huge chunk of the Bronx to make this highway.
Sure, it had, you know, a necessity to take down whatever was in its way, private houses and apartment houses, some stores, in that particular neighborhood. And it was probably started to be, the Major Deegan was probably being built in the early 1950s. I think it opened around 1955.
Wow.
And before that, I guess I was in I guess I was too young to know. But Broadway, there was one way out. The West Side Highway going up was the other way. Central Avenue through Yonkers was the main street. And way over on the east side was Route 1, the Boston Post Road.
You know, I want to give our listeners the benefit of something very special that is happening with the Visitation Parish in the Bronx, and maybe you can fill us in from there. Big reunion taking place tomorrow. But anyway, fill us in.
Yeah, the other month I got a call from one of the guys who was in school with us, and it's a credit to the way the sisters taught us in arithmetic. He said, you know, 2014 is 65 years since we graduated in 1949. And there were 44 kids in the class. And there were 22 girls and 22 boys. And of them, two of the boys became priests. And one was a missionary in India working with Mother Teresa with all that hardship and malaria and leprosy and whatnot. And the other one was a priest in Alaska, of all places. They both spent all of their ministries in those two places. And this fellow said that they were both going to be in town in July, and why don't we get together and have a sort of a reunion? And I said, that's fine with me, Jack. And he, I guess through the internet and stuff, was able to come up with a sizable number of people that were in that class with us. He got a dozen or so of the boys, and he had a handful of the girls. The girls were harder to track because of the name change when they were married. But and then of course he came up with about a dozen or so that aren't with us anymore. And he made a deal with the.
Now what's his name? Jack? What was?
Jack Verrier.
Okay.
And Jack is a businessman out in New Jersey somewhere, in Northern Jersey by Tenafly, one of those places. And he deserves a lot of credit for putting this whole thing together, and sending emails to everyone that's involved and whatnot, so he'll be the. I hope he'll be the master ceremonies tomorrow.
Excellent. Now there's a mass right in back to Visitation Parish in the church tomorrow.
Yes, that's right. In the church, 2:00 tomorrow afternoon. The two of the priests that were in the class are going to celebrate it with another a man by the name of Father John John Sullivan.
Yeah.
John Sullivan was also a 49 graduate, but he went to a different school. However, he was assigned to visitation for many years. He's now semi-retired, living in the O'Connor residence up here in Riverdale. But he keeps his finger in on the pulse of everything. And so the three of them, as they used to say, there'd be three priests on the altar.
How about that?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, this will be, this is a public event. And I believe that after the Mass, everybody is moving up for the chit-chat, because this is the height of bad manners to be talking during Mass. You could get a clip in the ear, even at your tender age and mine. But Rory Dolan's, there's going to be a gathering up there, too.
That's right. After the Mass is over, they've arranged to have everybody, you know, it's only a hot skip and a jump up to Deegan, of all places, to Dolan's.
Yeah.
And so we'll all get together up there and have a little get-together.
We only have a couple of minutes left in this hour, but Tom Hughes wanted to kind of wrap this up in terms of the reality in this day and age that a parish-like visitation, again, in the Bronx, is constantly under threat of closure, imminent closure. How is that perceived? I know, for instance, that the alumni say, oh, it's not a hell of a shame and so forth. But what's the general feeling on, say, an icon of the Bronx just literally kind of closing down, that's it, it's all over?
You know, it's a shame, but it's a fact of life. They just don't have enough priests to handle them anymore. I was with a man on Thursday who the same thing is being threatened with St. Gabriel's Church, which is another one up here.
Yeah.
And this guy that I was with is a substantial man in the community, and he wrote a long letter to Cardinal Dolan about why the St. Gabriel's Church should not be closed down. And he had one reason after another. And he said, you know what, I got a lovely letter back from the Cardinal. He says, but it didn't address any of those points that I had made.
Yeah.
So although it was very friendly, the deed is done, I guess. It's one of those things. They're just going to get over with it. Now, Father Leonard down in Holy Trinity,
right,
same way, making him retire. He says he's ready, willing, and able to stay on.
Right.
And they say, no, it's time to go.
Wow. Well, he's going to be a big personal loss to our family, because I don't know who's going to bury us. You know, he's done a great job so far. Geez, we'll have to get a new guy.
One of my brothers had his eye on it, but he didn't follow through. We can get him to stand in for us, I guess, when the time comes.
Tom Hughes, thank you for calling us.
Thanks.
Again, it's Visitation Parish in the Bronx, friends, and the do, as they say, is going to be up at Rory Dolan's afterwards. Thank you, Tom.
Really great talking to you, Adrian.
Okay,
thank you. God. Bye
now. All right, friends, we are about to switch over to WVNJ 1160 on the AM dial, of course. If you're listening to us on irishradio.com, then you don't have to do anything. Just stay exactly where you are. We'd be delighted if you can spend the time with us. We have a nice program coming up. We're even going to have some music in the way. Flannelly Show, live from New York City, capital of the world. Wherever you are, we want to bid you a warm hello and a falcha from New York City. You may have been listening to us indeed for the last hour, and this is the Adrian Flannelly Show. It was so named 44 years ago because we couldn't come up with a name for the program. And besides, those who were much wiser than I said, you're not going to last anyway, so it wasn't kind of worthwhile. But anyway, that's I only mentioned that because we broadcast on Saturday mornings from 9 o'clock until high noon, until 12, and I've been doing this, as I say, for more, for some 44 years. Glucksman Ireland House at NYU have agreed, indeed, to take over the first hour of our programming, and we couldn't be more delighted, friends, because it is terrific. And Glucksman Ireland House, where did Miriam Nighan go? Oh, here she is. Miriam, you're very welcome indeed. How are you?
Good, thank you. Absolutely great.
Now, as I say, Glucksman Ireland House, and we spoke about it earlier on the program, but many stations have now joined us. And including, of course, our the station where we were born, bred, buttered, speaking in the broadcast lingo, WVNJ 1160 on your AM dial here in the immediate area, the metropolitan area of New York, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Glucksman Ireland House. Again, the brainchild, as we had mentioned before, of Loretta and Lou Glucksman going back 21 years ago. And, you know, for those who haven't visited or seen Glucksman Ireland House and who may feel that, okay, that this may be a section of NYU, maybe a few rooms or something, wow, when you look at when you talk about an Irish icon in the city of New York, Glucksman Ireland House, a standalone building, its own address, number one Washington Mews. It's such an amazing and indeed not only addition for the Irish New York. There can be nothing like this, you know, ever again. I mean, you think that that was 21 years ago, the extraordinary vision and generosity and philanthropy of the Glucksmans, just to say, well, there's nothing like this, so let's just do it.
Yeah, no, it's a remarkable legacy that the late Lou, unfortunately I didn't have the pleasure of meeting him. He passed away just as I arrived at Glucksman Ireland House, but Loretta Brennan Glucksman, his wife, has continued the legacy and has been just such a wonderful supporter of what we do. And it's amazing on a number of levels that it has evolved into such an important part of the community for Irish New York and the community of Greenwich Village in terms mm-hmm. of people who have interest in things Irish. And, you know, people come into us in a variety of ways. They might have an interest in Joyce, and we are hosting a talk or something or a lecture, or they're interested in the music. They come to one of the Blarney Star concert series, concerts organized by Don Mead, or they're interested in some of our Irish language classes, which we also offer in the evening time. People cross the threshold of one Washington Mews for a variety of reasons that all are kind of brought together generally by an interest in something to do with this mm-hmm. tiny little island off the northwest coast of Europe that has had, you know, objectively speaking, such an amazing impact on literature, on the world, in music and dance and on so many levels. We kind of take it for granted when we're from Ireland and when we're of Irish descent because you grow up with it.
Yeah.
But when you step back and look at the impact of other tiny places, small islands like ours, that's not always the way yeah. it is, you know. And in large part, a lot of the impact is because people have been forced for a variety of reasons to leave the island.
Right.
So the rich heritage and culture, one of the, you know, positive parts of that has been that people in all parts of the world, you know, far more, you know, exotic places in a way than mm-hmm. New York, you know, I mean, New York really for large parts of Ireland for a long time, and even arguably today, you know, is literally the next parish over. And, you know, there are lots of people here from that place. But think about, you know, the Irish missionaries going to places in Africa, Australia, all over Argentina, just so many places. It's an unbelievable heritage that, and it's an, you know, Luxman Ireland House has kind of established itself as a really nodal point and, you know, a hub of how we engage and learn about the Irish experience.
I think perhaps a lot of a great number of listeners to our program would know of Marion Casey and the amazing research and work and her involvement indeed in making Luxman Ireland House, you know, the fabulous place that it is. Marion Casey, was she there when you came, or was she... Well, tell us a little bit about her own research.
Marion is the son of Irish immigrants, or sorry, the daughter of Irish immigrants, Carlo dad and a Dingle mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she grew up not not dissimilar from myself in terms of having the ear cocked, as we'd say in Ireland, listening to the old stories and the history and things like that. And that saw Marion go through and pursue history as her degree and her master's, and then a PhD in New York University.
Incredible, yeah.
And she, alongside of her scholarly research, which, I mean, is just second to none in terms of how she writes and the scholarship, but she began collecting materials, Adrian. She's probably collecting materials over the last close to 30 years, if the truth be known. And what that involved was sometimes getting a phone call late at night saying, or in the middle of her vacation saying, somebody has archival material or stuff that might be of interest to people down the line. Do you want to take a look at it? And, you know, she became a bit of a dumpster diver, as we call them, in terms of salvaging material that possibly would have ended up being thrown out.
Yeah.
And because of this gift of Luxman Ireland House and a willingness of New York University to formalise the collections that Marion started, really, in, I believe it was 1997, the Archives of Irish America was formalised, which is housed at Bope's Library at New York University, and is an important division of the library collection at this point in time. And there are close to 75 collections in that now. There were massive donations of musical material from world-renowned ethnomusicologist Professor Mick Maloney, who's on faculty with us, and 70-odd other collections that have made this an invaluable resource for anyone.
Right.
And that what Marion Casey has single-handedly done in establishing that archive and going out and salvaging material and, you know, taking phone calls after Hurricane Sandy, where, you know, there are a massive collection, a private collection of material held by an individual, and Marion was there right away, and that wasn't easy work in terms of salvaging some of the material. But
I think we will you know, remember Marion Casey more for the amazing research and work she did on the Irish in New York and the archives. They weren't known as archives; they were storage areas of Emigrant Savings Bank, and the wealth of information about, well, of course, it was all immigrants, but primarily Irish immigrants who came here, you know, and who came to New York and opened up savings accounts and had to come up with some kind of ID as we know it, and so that in fact, the record showing who came from where and what part of Ireland and, you know, basic information. But that gave New York, forever and a day, the best possible record, and it painted for us the fabric of the Irish and American, particularly the Irish in New York.
Absolutely, Adrian, and you know, I'm no expert. Marion is the right person to get into the nuts and bolts of it, which she can do so eloquently. But I mean, the general thing about the Emigrant Savings Bank material is that these generalizations, and you know, you mentioned stereotypes earlier, Adrian, that we ourselves sometimes use on ourselves. You know, yes, people are arriving during the famine and they're in, dire straits in terms of financial status, possibly health, etc., etc. They've survived the trauma of something as catastrophic as the famine. And not too long after, we're seeing these types of people going in and opening savings accounts and saving substantial amounts of money. You know, it undermines some of the stereotypes we have of this idea of the feckless Irish immigrant or a group of immigrants who weren't looking at upward mobility and looking to the future,
are the caricatures that we see of the Irish and the drink and the, you know, that was kind of what a scourge.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm sure if we go to any ethnic group, particularly new waves of immigrants coming into America, it kind of goes with the territory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we were singularly the only ethnic group who felt that they were an easy target. They felt the bigotry and the prejudice and all of the other things that go along with that.
No, I agree, Adrian. I mean, any group that comes in, even today, in big numbers into a place in a sometimes, you know, fairly confined period of time, stereotypes and animosity and things like that are unfortunately part of the part for the course. I guess in the Irish case as well, it's complicated by our relationship with Britain and the fact that, you know, stereotypes and waspy outlooks of the Irish in New York or in the United States in the period around the famine would have been so strong and would have been reiterated in the newspapers, in popular press and things like that. So that there was, I mean, some of the stereotypes ascribed to the Irish that linger even today, sometimes I find it quite comical to come across them today when you meet someone and they throw them at you, often jokingly, but that they still persist today. You know, those stereotypes did one hell of a job in terms of sticking around, you know, but that's the nature of stereotypes.
Miriam Nyhan, who, as the summer goes along, will initially be a co-host of my first hour of programming from 9 to 10 on WNYE 91.5 FM, New York Public Radio, HD Radio 1, and might I point out I assume sooner or later will be get its own title and its own theme, but initially it will be the Glucksman Ireland House radio program on Saturday mornings. I'll continue mine, by the way, in case anybody feels that I'm being put out to pasture. There have been several attempts to put me out to pasture, but I pick. I'm from Mayo, and I won't have any part of it.
We won't do that to you.
No, you won't. And I'm telling you that. Good. Program, again, the first and only Irish program ever to be broadcast on a New York City-owned radio station. So very well worth preserving, and I have to say that I'm absolutely delighted that Loretta Brennan Glucksman, indeed the founder, and that Joe Lee, who is the director of Glucksman Ireland House. And of course, it was easy for them all to make that decision, because without asking you at all, they said, oh, you're kidding, that's duck soup. Mary in my hands, she's not that busy down there anyway. She only works 50 or 60 hours a week. Sure, she can do that, and so you're welcome, Anna.
Adrian, on behalf of everyone at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, and I'll speak for Loretta and Joe, you know, to thank you for allowing us this opportunity to be part of what you've built up over the last 40 odd years. It's a great opportunity. We're really excited about it, and we hope that we can do justice to what you've been doing here for such a long time and doing so well. So thank you.
Okay. Mutual Admiration Society here, friends. This is the Flannelly Show. We're coming to you live from New York. And, of course, our programs are simulcast worldwide on irishradio.com. And then...